Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County. Not just wine country, but farm country. And you know, when you think about farms, what do you think about? You think about food. And when I think about food, I think about one of the leading thinkers, investigators, educators, and talkers, as it were, about food today. Somebody who really knows what's going on and who cares about it and loves it, even as she's unearthing some really cautionary, let's just say, let's be polite to begin with, information about food and about how food comes to us. Welcome back to At the Table, Dr. Marion Nessel.
Hi, glad to be here.
It's always good to talk to you. Now, we're talking about your really, really straightforward and wonderful new book, Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. How did this book come to be?
Well, I've been writing about these issues for a long time. I wrote my first article about the influence of food industry funding on nutrition research in 2001, and I incorporated it into food politics, and then I wrote about it again in soda politics. And then I started collecting studies that I ran across that were funded by food companies that had predictable results. It had gotten so I could look at the title of a study and see what the result was and guess who the funder was. So
yeah.
It was becoming a game. Guess the funder. So if I saw something that said that mangoes were better than fiber in doing something about constipation, which is a real study,
I
would say, oh, I bet the mango board funded that, and bingo. And because journals now require authors to say who paid for the study and whether they had any other kinds of financial arrangements with the funder, you can look these things up. And it was possible to do that. And I was post every time I ran across five of these, I just put them up on my blog. And I did that for a year. And at the end of the year, I had 168 studies. And 156 of them had results that the company had paid for.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that there aren't studies that come out negatively. It's just there are very few of them, and they're very hard to find. And so that was going on. And while that was going on, the New York Times wrote about Coca-Cola's funding of the Global Energy Balance Network, which is a group of researchers who were arguing that physical activity was more important than diet in what you weighed, which is against most other evidence.
Well, and common sense.
Yeah, and common sense, and they neglected to mention that they were funded by Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah.
And the New York Times found out about it, did a huge, huge article about it. I was quoted in it, and they posted my quote as a banner across the top of an inside page. I got called by a million reporters the following week, and the reporters were shocked.
Yeah.
They were shocked that Coca-Cola would fund something like this. They were shocked that researchers would take money to do something like this. And they were shocked that universities would allow their faculty to do this. I thought, oh, I've got another book to write.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to read something from the introduction or just before the introduction. I don't usually do this, but I think this is a really great way to tell people about this book. What happens when one of the country's great nutrition investigators follows the money in food and science? You get this riveting, provocatively written book, which deftly explores how the processed food industry has deepened our dependence on its products by sponsoring and manipulating food research for decades. This book should be read by anyone who has ever been seduced by the words, "New study shows," which is all of us. And that was Michael Moss. I mean, how prevalent is this? You talk about how journalists who cover this all the time were surprised. Why were they surprised?
Well, nobody believes that funding has anything to do with the outcome of research. And it's not intuitively obvious. And it's not intuitively obvious because, and there's been tons and tons of research on this, not in the food area, but for cigarettes and chemicals and pharmaceutical drugs. There's just 50 years of research that shows that industry funding affects the design and outcome of research, and that people, the researchers don't realize it.
All right, well, we're going to get into that in a minute, but I want you to tell everybody how you got involved with Coca-Cola following you and that you were part of Hillary's emails.
Oh, well, I start the book by talking about the Russian hacking of the 2016 election. Okay, so the obvious question is, what on earth does that have to do with what this book is about? Well, it was just amazing to me when those emails were posted of Hillary Clinton's staff people, and they were posted on a site called DC Leaks by Guccifer, whoever Guccifer
is. That's right.
You know, but clearly linked to the Russians. I got calls from people saying, Marion, you're in these emails. I thought, oh, you've got to be kidding me. I didn't have anything to do with Hillary's staff. What am I doing there? And it turns out that one of Hillary's staff people, or somebody who was working with her, was also a consultant for Coca-Cola at the time and was getting $7,000 a month for her consulting. Pretty good deal, actually.
Yeah.
And in the emails that were collected from her was one from somebody who went to a lecture that I had given to the Nutrition Society in Australia at the University of Sydney in 2016 when I was a visiting scholar there, and took notes on my talk, and very good notes actually, and passed them up through the chain of command. So they ended up in this email cache, and with recommendations to follow my activities in Australia and also follow the activities of the woman in whose research group I was working at the time. And I thought, really? Coca-Cola is working on influencing what people are saying to the extent that they go to a lecture that I gave in Australia? I couldn't believe it.
Phenomenal. It's shocking, phenomenal, and also very common these days. I mean, we are beginning to understand what's going on behind the curtain. We're talking with Marion Nestle, Dr. Marion Nestle, and we're talking about her new book, Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. Now, I've got to ask you about two of the most popular foods going, chocolate and almonds. Talk about how we've come to believe that they will solve all of our ills, do our laundry, and walk the dog.
Well, first of all, let me say they're wonderful foods.
Let me not
in any way criticize either of those foods. But Mars, some years ago, maker of M&Ms and other yummy things, realized that chocolate, a plant extract, had flavonoids in it, and that they could, that flavonoids were antioxidants and associated with good health, and that if they could get research that could demonstrate that chocolate flavanols were healthy, they could sell chocolate as a health food. And they funded hundreds of studies early on and began advertising chocolate as a health food. The FDA intervened, and they switched, and they now have flavanol supplements. You don't have the same rules about what you can say about supplements that you do about foods. But by the time they made that switch, the word was out was that dark chocolate was a health food, never mind how much of it you would have to eat to get any meaningful level of antioxidants. And Mars is having to deal with that now because they're much more careful, but the word is out.
The word is out. And there's chocolate, you know, it's kind of amazing. I love knowing one of the reasons for one of the phenomena I see all over the country. I mean, I like to buy ice cream once in a while, and it's nearly impossible to go to the ice cream door in the grocery store and not have everything with chocolate in it. I mean, it's as if chocolate has been added to everything, and almonds, by the way, but chocolate has been added to everything as this additional treat, additional dimension, additional antioxidant, and it's become pervasive. Maybe that was the direct desire, but it certainly has been an indirect result of all these studies and pushing all this information, hasn't it?
Well, and if you look at the statements of the Confectioners Association and the other trade associations for the candy industry, they think Americans don't eat enough candy.
Yeah. I'm sure they're worried at night. All right. Well, but before we've only got about a minute and a half in this segment, I do want to go to page 14 and talk about that simple list of things that the pharmaceutical and the tobacco companies learned how to do so that they could get their point across. It's so prevalent in our culture. Can you grab that real fast?
Oh, well, I don't know the page offhand, but I assume you're talking about the tobacco industry playbook.
Yep.
Which is the term that's given to the set of strategies developed by the tobacco industry to cast doubt on the science that linked cigarette smoking to lung cancer. I mean, the tobacco industry knew about the connection between cigarettes and lung cancer way, way, way before anybody else did. But they had a concerted, deliberate corporate strategy to try to cast doubt on that.
All right, I'm going to jump in and read the list really quickly because we have to go to break, but it's cast doubt on the science, fund research to produce desired results, offer gifts and consulting arrangements, use front groups, promote self-regulation, promote personal responsibility as the fundamental issue, and use the courts to challenge critics and unfavorable regulations. We're going to talk more about all of this and about what we eat with Dr. Marian Nestel when we return in a moment at the table. We are back at the table. I am here with Dr. Marian Nestel. She is the author of yet another brilliant book, this one called Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. Talk a little bit about this game plan that companies, product companies of all kinds, maybe coined or created or solidified by the tobacco companies, but that are, you know, that are used by many big companies to position and promote and sell what they make.
Yeah, I mean, the strategies are if you're making a product with questionable effects on health, you want to cast doubt on the science. And I think the easiest example in food and beverage is Coca-Cola, which has funded literally hundreds of studies to show that Coca-Cola is harmless. It does not ruin people's diets. It doesn't make them fat. It doesn't cause type 2 diabetes. And any studies that show that it might are so badly done methodologically that you should ignore everything they say. That's a very effective strategy, and you see it all the time. When there's a product, the first thing they say is, there's something wrong with the science. It doesn't really affect people. It was done in rats. It doesn't affect humans. And all you have to do is cast doubt on the science, and you're home free.
Yeah.
It's a very effective strategy. You know, there are movies made about it, Merchants of Doubt.
Yeah.
A terrific movie, by the way.
Yeah. Well, all right. So as doubt is being cast, right, there's another issue here that was probably developed most fully in the drug industry, but the psychology of gifts. Talk a little bit about how getting that, I don't know, free case of Coke, free bottle of olive oil, free trip to Tunisia. I don't know how something as simple as a pen can have an impact on a study.
Oh, well, this is 50 years of research on the influence of pharmaceutical industry funding on physicians' prescription practices. I mean, one of the things that's great about the drug industry, the pharmaceutical drug industry, is that you can measure the results because you can measure these things, because you can measure prescription practices before and after. You can measure sales of the products, and now there's this open payments database where the drug industry is required to put online the amount of money that they give to individual physicians, making research much, much easier. And this research shows without question that even small gifts will change prescription practices from generics or some other brand to the brand that the that is being that the supporter comes from, and that's been shown over and over and over again, so many times in so many different ways. It's really not arguable anymore.
You know, at the beginning of my career, I was a consultant to a pharmaceutical company. And as you're telling the story, you have explained to me why I quit the effort. I was doing lunches and dinners for 2,000 to 2,000 doctors all over the world. I mean, whether I went or not, I would plan it. And one of the things I kind of inherently knew to do, I found out where the people who were going to attend were from and made sure that there were little notes in the meal that made them feel comfortable and all the rest of it. And it was thousands and thousands of dollars. And I didn't think anything of it. I thought, I'm bringing nice food to nice people and we're feeding doctors and all the rest of it. And then one day I heard some of the people from the company talking about how they didn't think that AIDS was really going to be a business. So there's no point in developing drugs for this because it's not going to pencil. And I thought, there's something wrong with this. And I quit. And here you are all these years later explaining exactly how that is organized and what the impact might be.
Oh, and it's astonishingly effective, and that also has been demonstrated by thousands of studies and discussed in many, many, many books. Big gifts are more effective than small gifts, but small gifts still work.
Yep.
Meals are the most frequent gift these days. They work. And the other part of that entire line of research is that the recipients of the gifts didn't intend to be corrupted.
Right.
They didn't realize they were being corrupted. They were completely unconscious of it and deny it and believe that the gifts have no effect whatsoever on their behavior. And this is very human. This is how humans react to these kinds of things, but it's been very, very well studied. Much, much more in the pharmaceutical industry than it has, where there are literally thousands of studies and libraries of books. And then when I went to do an equivalent literature review for food and beverage, I found precisely 11 studies.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons Dr. Nessel's work is so effective is that she is completely serious, but never grim. She's lively. There's a cartoon early in the book where the doctor is prescribing and the doctor says, now this medication can cause weight gain. And the woman says, how so? And the doctor says, the drug company wines and dines me for prescribing it. I mean, what you're doing is that you're taking all of this research and all this analysis and you're putting it into a real life experience, aren't you?
I try to.
Well, you do a great job.
I mean, I think everybody, you know, I think people don't think about the influence of food companies on research. Reporters don't report it very often, although they're getting somewhat better. But they don't report it. People don't think about it. And the researchers themselves don't realize the way it looks or don't care about it or something. I don't know.
Well,
I wrote the book because I want them to care about it more.
And because you want them to know why and because you want them to, we want all of us, I think, it seems, to know how this construct works. There are other forces. You speak really clearly and in a very helpful way for me and for others about the difference between nutrition research and food science.
Oh yeah, they were two completely different fields. Food science grew out of the food industry's need for research on food products, and to find out much more about the components of food and what their effects were. But they were tied to the food industry from the beginning. That's why when you go to Cornell and give a lecture, you're giving a lecture in the PepsiCo auditorium.
Yep.
Completely understandable. Nutrition grew out of a completely different scientific background. It grew out of the discoveries of vitamins and minerals in the early 20th century, and the questions that were asked are very, very different, so that nutrition is really about the effects of food on health. The food science is about the ways in which food research can help the food industry. So conflicts of interest in food science are very rare, although now that food scientists are also starting to work on health, they're starting to be possible. And whereas conflicts of interest in nutrition research are quite possible if you're doing research on a product that might have unhealthful effects, like candy or soft drinks or something like that. If the company is sponsoring the research and you're not finding harmful effects, that's great for the company. If they're sponsoring your research, that's what they want. And the research that's looked at how that happens, and that too has been studied, is it's in the way the research question is framed, largely. So there's a big difference between asking the question, let's see what this food product does to health,
right,
and asking the question, let's get research to prove the benefits of this product.
Right, right. Let's find examples.
And I get letters all the time, from trade associations that are looking for research to demonstrate the benefits of yogurt, grapes, pecans, almonds, any food you can think of.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the specifics. We're going to talk about a fairly recent pressure for these companies to produce higher returns for stockholders. That's only going back until the 1980s, because before that, we didn't expect food to make that much money that quickly. We're going to talk more about what's behind all that, what a land grant university is, a college is, and how that ties into what we're told about what we're eating at lunch today, right back here at the table. We are back at the table. I'm here with Dr. Marion Nessel, and we're talking about unsavory truth when it comes to food and the information we get about our food. You coined a phrase that we're going to make a t-shirt for. I've been making a lot of t-shirts lately. This one's going to be called Nutri-Fluff. Tell us about that.
Oh, I've used that word for years to refer to nutrition studies that just sound wonderful and get lots and lots of press but don't have any real clinical significance. But they're just fun.
Give us a fluffy example. Well, I mean, you know, the whole chocolate and almond thing, again, as you said, we like chocolate, we like almonds, there are good things about them in a diet, but they may not be the answer to, I don't know, landing a man on the moon.
Well, chocolate's candy.
Yeah.
So it's probably a better example. I mean, any study that indicates that chocolate is a health food, that's Nutri-Fluff.
Yeah, that's Nutri-Fluff, right.
Because, I mean, if you think about it for 1 second, chocolate is fine, delicious, but it's candy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not broccoli.
It's not broccoli. That's the name of your next book, Chocolate is Not Broccoli. All right, so let's talk a little bit about selling the meat and dairy foods that have become such a big part of our lives.
Well, there I wanted to point out how closely involved the meat and dairy industry are with Department of Agriculture policy, which they are. And dairy is in big trouble these days. People aren't drinking as much milk as they used to. There's all this trade problem with Canada. The dairy industry's in trouble. And they want to sell more milk. That's their job. And I should say that food companies are not social service agencies, and nobody should expect them to be. Their job is to sell product and make stockholders happy. And that's really what they do. And to the extent that they do that, they're doing what their stockholders want.
But it wasn't always so, right? I mean, in a lot of cases, and certainly still in some other countries, the returns on food-related commerce, I think is what we're trying to say here, are not expected to be the same as widgets or tires or cars or headphones.
Well, we had a big change in 1981. 1981 is looked at as the start of the shareholder value movement, which was a movement from shareholders to get higher immediate returns on investment. Before that, remember blue chip stocks? You never hear anything about blue chip stocks anymore.
Nope.
Those were things like IBM that gave long, slow returns on investment throughout somebody's lifetime, but they never increased very much. That changed in the early 1980s when there was enormous pressure put on companies to produce higher returns right away.
Yeah.
And what that did to food companies in particular was to put them in just an impossible situation, because we already had more than 3,000 calories a day available in the food supply for every man, woman, little tiny baby, which is lots more than people needed. Now it's 4,000 calories a day per capita.
Amazing. And
food companies were already competing for people to buy their food instead of somebody else's, and they couldn't do it. And so they did everything they could to get people to eat more food in general. And they were wildly successful.
Yep.
Average weight gain in the United States was 15 or 20 pounds between 1980 and 2000. People are eating more. Portion sizes got larger. If I had one concept to get across, it would be that larger portions have more calories.
Yay. I mean, talk about straightforward. We're talking to Dr. Mary Nessel about her book, Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. But what you just told us was really complete common sense, a whole book to really explain, you know, more calories, more food, it makes more calories, and you really should know what you're eating, right?
Well, that would be nice. But the food industry has many, many ways of encouraging people to eat their products. And they do it through advertising, of course. Billions of dollars of advertising. And marketing in all different ways, making their brands iconic and sponsoring sports and music figures and so forth and so on. And research is one of the ways in which they do that. It's the one this book is focused on.
How
they fund research.
Well, and talking about this, you bring up the topic of a key example of one time it didn't work on a product called Olestra. And that's one of the products that early on I got exposed to. I was asked by somebody in the food industry to help them get across that Olestra was good and okay and should be used, and let's influence influencers in food to do that. Talk a little bit about how sometimes why it just doesn't work.
Yeah, well, we have to go back to the 1990s for this, when Procter & Gamble sunk a fortune, hundreds of millions of dollars, into creating an artificial fat. Remember, this was the time when everybody was worried about dietary fat.
Right.
This was an artificial fat that would therefore have no calories. And the idea was you would use this Olestra oil for frying potato chips and French fries and using it in other ways. And the FDA was very dubious about it for a couple of reasons. One was if you ate too much of it. Oh, I don't know how to say this.
Oh, you can say it. There was anal leaking. That was the point where I said, I'm sorry, I can't come to lunch with you because there might be some Olestra involved. I mean, it turns out it slid through your body and not in a nice way.
No, and taking the fat-soluble vitamins along with it. Eventually nothing much happened with it. I believe there are still some Olestra fried potato chips on the market under the brand Olean, but it basically failed. And they were sponsoring research to show its benefits, but the competitors of Procter & Gamble, like Unilever, were sponsoring studies to show that it was really tough on your vitamin A level.
All right. So in other words, it's not a straight assumption that every single misdirected study will result in unfortunate sales. It's a dynamic industry. How do we, we just have a few seconds in this particular segment, but we're going to talk a little bit more about disclosures and how people know about it, and how do we manage conflicts? What were the early attempts, but also what do we do about all of this? Because as people, I don't like to call us consumers. I like to think of us as people. Consumers are a statistic and people eat food. But what we can do as a culture and as individuals to sift through all of this, other than going back to that simple, you know, bowl of broccoli, and how we can make sense of it and maybe even take action to make it more clear. We'll be right back with Dr. Mary Nessel at the table. We are back talking Unsavory Truth with Dr. Marian Nessel and her new book of that name. Marian, talk a little bit about managing those conflicts, about disclosure, and about how we used to try to do this and how we're doing it now.
Well, one of the ways in which the whole question of the conflicts of interest that come up when food companies sponsor research is through disclosing them. And that way, if you read a scientific study and it says Coca-Cola is the best thing since sliced bread, and it's sponsored by Coca-Cola, you can be appropriately skeptical.
Yeah.
Or at least you can think about it a little bit. Journals didn't used to require any of that kind of information, but in 1984, the New England Journal of Medicine, very, very worried about the influence of pharmaceutical companies on physicians' research and practice, insisted that that authors of studies published in the New England Journal disclose two things. They had to say who paid for the study. Something that for years had been done voluntarily.
Right.
And then also whether they had any kinds of financial relationships with the company that had funded the study or another company with a similar product or a similar interest. And that made it possible to do the kind of research where you look to see who funded it and whether the authors had relationships with the company or not. And the nutrition journals didn't, the food and nutrition journals didn't do that until much later.
It's amazing to me. You know, there's one example I wanted you to mention because it's so shocking to me. The whole business about football concussions and chocolate milk.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that's an example. That's tell that story.
Yeah, that's a study that's so egregious that it gives the whole thing of industry funding a really bad name. This is a study at the University of Maryland in which an investigator at the University of Maryland did a study that was sponsored by a chocolate milk drink company and published something, or they did it, actually they did never published it, it was a press announcement that high school footballers who drank this chocolate milk had less symptoms of concussion than ones who didn't. And this study came out just as the furore about concussions in football players was beginning to get an enormous amount of attention. And imagine what something like that would do to the sales of a chocolate milk, of this particular chocolate milk product. Well, investigators and journalists immediately jumped in, and the first thing they noticed was there was no study. This was a press release.
Unbelievable.
And the author of the study did not disclose that this particular product was the sponsor of his study. And so there was just a big uproar of it, and the university had to take action, and no such study was ever published. And the last I saw, the product was pretty much out of business.
Well, and that's a good result. But in the meantime, the idea that this kind of a manipulation would go on to as you say, such an egregious level. All right. So besides disclosure, what else can we do?
Well, we can be skeptical.
Yeah.
We can insist that we can ask reporters when they're talking about some great new breakthrough. And by the way, my sort of guidelines for how to interpret nutrition research is if it's a breakthrough, no, it's not. if it's a miracle, no, it's not. If it's the best thing that ever happened, no, it probably isn't. If one food is said to be something that's going to do wonders for multiple conditions. I don't think so. People don't eat just one food. They eat one food as part of very complicated diets.
Right.
And then my favorite is whenever you hear anything you ever knew about nutrition is wrong, that's a sure sign that you're being told something that's very unlikely to be correct.
Do you think that we'll see the kind of lawsuits towards food companies that we saw towards tobacco?
Well, people are trying, but I think it's much more difficult because, you know, cigarettes are one product with one message, don't smoke.
Right.
With food, it's much more complicated. People eat diets of enormous complexity. And they're not only complex in general, but they change from day to day, from week to week, from month to month.
Yeah.
There have been studies that have looked at dietary intake over an entire year, and they find that in order to come anywhere close to the average intake of a nutrient during that year period, you would have to take 20 days of dietary intake data in order to get there. Most dietary studies take one.
Yeah. You know, it's a complex discussion. It's an ongoing process. It's not as easy and simple. But if you follow your guidelines, which you talked about a lot in What to Eat, about eating good fresh food and a good mixture of food and not too many proteins and as few processed foods as possible, you don't need to worry so much about the studies that prove that one ingredient that's been extracted and made into a powder is going to make you big and strong, do you?
No, you don't have to worry about it at all, really. And you look at these kinds of studies. I mean, if a study shows that a healthy food is healthy, duh.
All right, when we come back, we're going to have...
It's about marketing.
It's about marketing. We'll be right back at the table. We are back at the table, and I have to say that, as usual, Dr. Marianne Nestle has given me the answer to a lot of questions that I've had for a while, and if I ever have a question or want to explain something, I can hand them this new book, Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. Marianne, how do we find you? I know you have a website, you write, you're one of the top tweeters anywhere, aren't you?
Well, I don't know about that, but I have a website, foodpolitics.com, where my life is an open book. I put up my papers. I put up a list of all my lectures that I'm giving. I write a daily blog, and then it goes out over Twitter at Marianne Nestle.
And so if people want to find out where you'll be signing books and talking about this wonderful new book, how do they find that out too?
And they can look at foodpolitics.com under appearances, and they're all listed there. And there are three in the Bay Area in mid-November.
All right. Well, that's a good time to be in the Bay Area. It's a good time to be anywhere. And folks, when you come to see Dr. Marianne Nestle, take a look around and see which of the people are taking notes for Coca-Cola and are they writing them in Cyrillic? I mean, you know, we are very concerned about this. Marianne, going forward, again, if you were going to give in our last couple of minutes here, if you were going to give people some thought. I mean, what I love about this book is it tells simple stories and gives really solid, clear examples about why things we've logically thought for a long time are correct, that we should be cautious, we should be wary, and we should be moderate in our consumption of processed foods. But if people want to take additional actions that can have an impact on how this all happens every day, are there things that people can do?
Well, there are. I mean, first of all, be skeptical and use common sense. But I think, you know, people can insist that reporters look at who funded studies when they write about them. They can talk to their local universities and ask about that. They can complain if studies are published that are clearly, that just seem so clearly biased you can't possibly believe the results. And we're seeing in the newspapers, or at least I'm seeing in the New York Times, practically every day there's an article about some conflict of interest, usually in the pharmaceutical industry, but there was a big one about the alcohol industry recently,
yep.
funding a study to try to prove the benefits of one drink of alcohol a day.
Yeah. So in other words, in this day and age of social media and all this interaction between people online and other ways, when we speak up and say, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense, or who funded that, it can have an impact immediately on sales. And ultimately, maybe some of these things that we really shouldn't be eating or should be very cautious about how we eat will end up on the Olestra slag heap. Ooh, that's too visual. On the business failure list of things that didn't work out, because there's plenty of good things to eat. And if you want to know about what is good to eat and what to think about when you're deciding what to eat, always go to Dr. Marion Nessel and now her new book, Unsavory Truth. Marion, thank you so much for joining us as always.
Oh, my pleasure.